Our gospel reading for the morning begins in the 16th chapter of Luke's gospel from the first verse. Listen for God's word. Then Jesus said to the disciples, "There was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was squandering his property. So he summoned him and said to him, 'What is this that I hear about you? Give me an accounting of your management, because you cannot be my manager any longer.' Then the manager said to himself, 'What will I do now that my master is taking the position away from me? I am not strong enough to dig, and I am ashamed to beg. I've decided what to do so that when I am dismissed as manager, people may welcome me into their homes.' So, summoning his master's debtors one by one, he asked the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' And he answered, 100 jugs of olive oil. He said to him, 'Take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 50. Then he asked another, 'And how much do you owe?' And he replied, 100 containers of wheat. And he said to him, 'Take your bill and make it 80. And his master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. The children of this age are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than are the children of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of dishonest wealth, so that when it is gone, they may welcome you into the eternal homes. Whoever is faithful in a very little is faithful also in much, and whoever is dishonest in a very little is dishonest also in much. If then you have not been faithful with the dishonest wealth, who will trust you with the true riches? And if you have not been faithful with what belongs to another, who will give you what is your own? No slave can serve two masters. For a slave will either hate the one and love the other, or be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth." Friends, this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. In our house, we have been known to enjoy a board game or a card game from time to time. And these days it's pretty common for a deck of cards to show up after dinner, and over the course of the last decade of my life, I have played an almost uncountable number of games of Starry, of Phase 10, and recent years of Settlers of Catan. I enjoy all of them, and on any given night, any of us might win any of them, and I am so grateful that we have, by this point, fully and truly graduated from the one game I'd love to never go back to again. Just Candyland. Candyland is not a game that works well for grown-ups. It's not designed for us. I get that. First off, there's actually no decision-making anywhere in Candyland. You draw a card. The card tells you how many spaces forward you can go. Sometimes the spaces have different kinds of actions that would result. And eventually someone gets to the end of the line and wins. But because nobody makes a decision, once the deck is shuffled, the game is predetermined. So when you play it, all you're doing is finding out who has already won. But also, if you are a grown-up, you have to play Candyland by a different set of rules. It says it right there in the directions. It turns out that there are some spots on the board that should send you backwards. But, in the interest of saving time, the makers of Candyland have decreed that little kids don't have to play by those rules. They can just ignore those cards altogether, which means, and I don't want to say this very carefully, you can have fun playing Candyland, especially if you're playing it with an awesome kid or an awesome grandkid. But Candyland is not a fair game. The deck is stacked in more ways than one. And because, as much as I like being a dad, I also like winning. I like having an even chance to win. But in Candyland, I don't have an even chance. It feels profoundly unfair. And I want things to be fair. I bet you want things to be fair. We all love to say that we want things to be fair, which makes this parable infamously difficult. The question that came in for this series to generate this particular sermon was, in fact, a laser set on the notorious unfairness of the parable. What the heck is up with the parable of the dishonest manager, it said. Why is it so unfair? And where, pray tell, is the fairness of God? A rich man has a financial manager who gets accused of impropriety. The manager gets dragged before his boss and accused and starts to get understandably a bit nervous. After all, he's no good for manual labor, and if the boss throws him out, he won't have a way to get food on the table. So he devises a scheme. He goes around to the master's debtors and starts writing down their debts. Instead of 100, 50. Instead of 100, 80. And so on, in the hopes that those debtors might repay the manager down the line by offering him a place to rest his head. From a legal standpoint, there's only one way to read this story. This manager has stolen the wealth of the man who employs him. A pretty cut and dry violation of the seventh commandment. He's attempting to buy his way through a miscarriage of justice. And as we read, we can hardly wait for the boss to find out and for this manager's comeuppance to come up. But instead, because this is a parable, and because reading a parable is like tossing a ball in the air and having it go sideways, instead the boss comes back and says, "Well done, congratulations, good job." And Jesus comes in with a little bit of narration to say, make friends for yourself by means of dishonest wealth, so that when it is gone, they may welcome you into the eternal home. Not fair. Why should this manager get rewarded for his dishonesty? And more to the point, it's infuriatingly unfair because its very unfairness is the thing that Jesus himself shows up to commend. Look, life isn't always going to be fair. I get that. Sometimes the deck is stacked. I get that. Some people have more money. I get that. Some people are going to have more access. I get that. Some people with more money and more access are going to get away with things that other people won't get away with. I don't like it, but I get it. But what I don't get and what I don't like and what boils my blood is Jesus showing up at the end of this parable and giving this unfairness the big old Jesus seal of approval. I don't expect life to be fair. I do expect God to be fair. So what the heck is up with the parable of the dishonest manager? The first thing I would notice is that the manager isn't the only dishonest actor in the story. Dishonest wealth, our translation also uses later in the text. One could only imagine how we might read the parable if only the editors had chosen for its title one dishonest protagonist over the other. The parable of the dishonest wealth would, I think, encourage a very different kind of initial approach. And with much credit to UPC's own Margaret Amer, who is today preaching this same parable in a different pulpit and pointed this exact turn out to me, it would be entirely consistent with the original Greek language of the parable to translate this man's title not as dishonest manager, but as a manager of dishonesty. A manager of injustice. A manager of unfairness. In this translation, perhaps, it is not the manager who is himself dishonest. Rather, it is only his fate to be the one trying to keep up with the dishonesty swirling around him, an injustice that has permeated the world around him, an unfairness in which the gap between those who have and those who have not has taken over. Debt has buried everyone in this story to the point that they worry whether or not anyone will take them in. But our hero, at least, he's managing. And perhaps as he begins to break the rules of this system, maybe then something of the true fairness of God begins to peek through the clouds. About a decade ago, at the age of 27, a Pensacola man named Trenton Copeland stood before a federal judge and heard his sentence read. He had been found guilty of possession and intent to distribute cocaine, the third time for him that he'd been found guilty of a nonviolent drug offense. Unfortunately for him, in the federal system, the prosecutors had taken advantage of something called Section 851 enhancement, which, when deployed, required judges to impose mandatory minimum sentencing of at least 20 years. So in Copeland's case, at the age of 27, having committed no violent crime, he, on that day, was sentenced to life in federal prison without the possibility of parole. There's nothing in the prosecution of Copeland's case that is, at first, unjust. He's rightly convicted of crimes which he did commit, a fact he himself admits. He broke the rules. He knowingly broke the rules. And the judge who sentenced him did not do so in defiance of the rules for sentencing guidelines, but in fact in a full-throated embrace of them. And yet, somehow, in this persistent following of the rules, some broader injustice has occurred. At the age of 33, 5 years into his sentence, Copeland writes an open letter eloquently describing his dreams of what he would be for his community if ever he were released, if ever he were free, if ever he could pay his debt. By then it is clear that the prison system has done its job. It has reformed him into precisely the sort of member of society that we could all hope to be. But in doing so, it has not also managed to reform itself. And so even in his reformed state, he is still stuck in an unreformed world, the rest of his life laid out behind bars. The good news for Trenton Copeland came in late January of 2017, when his name was included among the very last batch of presidential pardons given prior to the inauguration. Trenton Copeland was made that day a free man and remains a free man who served his time and paid his debt. But it was only by a suspension of justice that justice could be served. His was to owe 50, not 100, 30, not 50, 5, not life. His was to owe just a bit less, and to therefore be freed, and to therefore be welcomed again into the arms of his neighbors, wherein he rests still, with thanksgiving for all of the allies and all of the attorneys and all the activists who worked on his behalf, and tirelessly in a maze of courtrooms and conference rooms, who worked tirelessly for justice inside a system that doesn't always guarantee it. None of them can fix the injustice completely, but at least they could manage it for a little while. But I wonder if this is some glimpse of the true fairness of God. Not a fairness in which everyone gets the same chance and everyone plays by the same rules and the deck is never stacked. Rather, perhaps God's fairness overflows with mercy, and God's fairness overflows with forgiveness, and God's fairness overflows with grace. And in God's fairness, it is, of course, the most vulnerable and the most forgotten and the most at risk to whom the most is given. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, Jesus says. For the sake of fairness, it might as well say, blessed are those who are persecuted in the name of fairness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven, where all the candy is, and where no child should ever have to go backwards. Thanks be to God. Amen.